Small details or big surfaces, tight corners or odd shapes, flat, rounded, textured, or tall. Whatever your next project, there's a spray paint pattern that's just right. Because Rust-Oleum's new Custom Spray 5-in-1 gives you control with 5 different spray patterns. So you can tackle nooks, crannies, edges, and curves without worrying about drips, runs, uneven coverage, or anything else. Custom Spray 5-in-1. Only from Rust-Oleum.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the latest episode of the Red Men Weekly podcast. Hope all is well wherever you are. I'm Steve Hoare, bringing you the best clips from our Red Men Plus content from the previous week. Hope, like I say, let you guys know, like I always do, these shows are available in full over on redmenplus.com. You can get them in video or podcast form over there. So yeah, if you want to get more Liverpool content in your lives, and if you want to help support the stuff that we do here at Red Men, yeah, go please check out redmenplus.com and see if it is for you. Right then, let's start. The first clip from this week's show is the Biased Football Podcast. You've got Paul and the gang having a good old chat about some non-Liverpool things. And yeah, this one was actually a really, really funny one. Check it out.
Anyway, speaking of teams that should be winning games that you expect them to, but don't. Chelsea Football Club, ladies and gentlemen. I'm just going to read a little quote for you. From Maurizio Pochettino, who said, we are not the Chelsea that won the Champions League or Premier League. Mm-hmm. Tuchel arrived in a project that was already built. We need to accept that it's a project for the future.
Yeah, you don't know your fan base, do you?
Do you know who you're managing, Maurizio Pochettino?
Right.
I can't say anything else, but lads, if this keeps going on for the next month, then you're gone. Like, you don't get time here. That's just that simple. And also, it doesn't help when your owner's gone and spent £1 billion, because £1 billion, and if you read out the squad that played the other day, I could name you about 5 players who I actually know of. That's not £1 billion worth of players. It shouldn't be anyway, because no one should be worth that amount of money. But it should be much better than that. I don't understand this philosophy. I don't know what he's trying to do at this moment in time, because whatever he's doing, it's not working. And yeah, they are literally stuck in a rut, and I'm absolutely living for it. But if he thinks he's getting time, you were in the Premier League, you should know.
He's not wrong to say the things that he's saying, because they have got a young squad. Yeah. That was their strategy, was to buy young, put them on long contracts, mm-hmm. and obviously try and build something sustainable, throw loads of money at it, but not be, they don't want to continue to spend loads and loads of money, because eventually FFP will just come and bite them in the arse. There's no way. There's only so many ways you can kick that down the road. You know, as they can continue to sell players onto the Saudi League, yeah. You know, like, no questions asked. But As just a footballing project, and taking aside, you know, all the dodgy kind of dealings behind the scenes, Pochettino's not wrong. You know, he's come in and he's being asked to shape this side and this squad.
He's a good manager as well. Yeah. I think he could create something really good, but you will not be given the time.
It's such an ill-fitting job for him that it never made any sense. And Chloe's right.
It's an ill-fitting project for Chelsea Football Club.
Yes,
to try and decide that Chelsea now want to do this as a project.
Well, it's fascinating, because Chelsea fans have obviously become accustomed to the Abramovich way of working, which is very much, if it doesn't go right for a short period of time, out the door you go. Even if it does go right in some instances, out the door you go, because he just had that mentality. He was very cutthroat in that, and he just got rid of managers willy-nilly. The turnover was ridiculous at times. So they've gone, you don't know what it looks like now under the Bowley administration. What we do know is he spends a hell of a lot of money. So you'd imagine he'd want things to be going better on the pitch than they are right now. There's no two ways about that. But from the fan base, are they, Are they willing to change their ways and allow Pochettino time? That's the big one for me. Because, like I say, they become accustomed to it. Was it 2 decades worth of Abramovich? Just chopping and changing managers left, right and centre. You're not working, out you go. And are they going to expect that now? Probably, because you get set in your ways, don't you? And it's not working. It's not working by any stretch of imagination. It is the gift that keeps on giving at the minute, Chelsea Football Club. They are miles off it. And Chloe's right. Their squad is a shambles given the amount of money they've spent. It's terrible.
They're starting 11 against Aston Villa at the weekend. Robert Sanchez in goal.
He's crap.
He's just crap.
Malo Gusto, right back, who again not sounds like he does an absolutely splendid, a restaurant that does a splendid carbonara. Axel De Sarcy.
He's not that good.
Axel
either.
Disaster.
Oh, God.
Thiago Silva, still.
He's 37.
At least.
I'd be older, yeah.
I mean, I think he's 38 now. Oh. Levi Colwill, left back.
Yeah. Good decision, mate.
A double pivot of Moises Caicedo.
He's having a lovely
and
chat.
Conor Gallagher.
I was Conor Gallagher in your starting 11.
43-1, the three in front. Raheem Sterling.
Fantastic.
Enzo Fernandez.
Crap.
And Mikhailo Mudryk.
Crap.
Who has got Bruno Cheyri written all over him, by the way. There's clearly an all right, fundamentally, there's an all right player in there, but sitting around him and going, oh, it's going to come. There's just some footballers for whom it never does. And you need to see more, I think, you know, in the spell. You often find when you look back and go, that never worked out, you go, that first like 10 games, you needed to see something. Like, let's look at like Dejan Kulusevski as an example. Yeah. Comes in on loan and just absolutely hits the ground running. Just, you know, does enough. Like Liverpool got Nicholas Anelka on loan. Doesn't score loads of goals, but you can see there's a player there from minute one. He feels like one of them, that he'll go out on loan somewhere and come back and have a good loan spell and come back and he'll be the one where they're going, oh, we had a good loan spell here. Maybe he'll kick on. I'm not sure.
Do you know
Nicholas Jackson up front, by the way?
Who I think is a good footballer, but can't put it in the back of the net. You know, the weird thing about Mudryk, though, is, and sorry to go back to Arsenal, but you know how I mentioned I felt like Arsenal needed reinforcements? They put like a 90 mil bid in on the table for Mudryk. So do you reckon it would have turned out differently for Arsenal? Or also, if Arsenal knew they needed backup and they were going to go and spend 90 mil on Mudryk, do you think it was just a case of they realised that they could get Declan Rice, that they've decided to put it all into that instead?
There was loads of dodgy things around the Mudryk stuff, wasn't there? It was to do with, there was like payments directly to
they got Trossard, didn't they, on the back of Mudryk?
It's a different ball game in terms of money, isn't it?
Yeah, there's a sliding doors thing where Arsenal get him and they don't get to put the money in somewhere else. No, I think that's an interesting point.
He ran past James Milner, though, we shouldn't forget that.
That's a 30-something-year-old man for pace three times, and apparently he was the best footballer that's ever been.
It just happens for some footballers sometimes, and sometimes it just dozens, you know. You come to Chelsea, there is a lot of pressure on that, and for whatever reason it's not worked so far. But sorry, Chloe, I just go to the bench. Leslie Ugochukwu, Amando Brozier, who's amazing that he's there still. Cole Palmer, £65 million.
Oh my god,
£60 million Cole Palmer, ladies and gentlemen. Ben Chilwell, I think he's great.
I like him.
Cucurella. I mean, again, you've got £100 million worth of left backs on the bench. Dode Petrovic, Ian Mattson,
he's a keeper.
David Washington, and Lucas Bergstrom.
Yeah, no idea.
And my question was going to be, where's the £1 billion?
We don't know.
But in saying so, again, there's £100 million worth of left backs.
Well, maybe more, because I think, isn't that Mattson?
In fact, he's another.
I'm just checking now. I'm sure he plays left back.
Yeah,
he plays left back. He's a kid, he's a caddy. There's three left backs on that bench.
Why
are they playing Levi Colwill at left back instead of centre back and just playing? And probably
because it's probably not. There's probably an inversion thing going on where Gusto maybe cuts in a bit or whatever he's playing, but. Gusto did cut in.
You know what I don't think gets spoken about enough Enzo Fernandez being £105 million, because he's been non-existent since he's been
They're playing him.
You think he's £105 million?
No, he's a good footballer. I don't know if he's a good footballer.
And then there's £105 million. He's not £105 million.
Chelsea overpaying for players isn't exactly breaking news.
Why is that not being spoken about though?
Your point goes back to, I remember making this on Thursday Night Pint last season, of the most expensive midfielders in the world of all time, and Artur Melo was still in the top 10 most expensive midfielders ever for the transfer from Barca to Juve, and the point stood. Like, Zidane was in the top 10, you know, from 20 years earlier on. Kevin De Bruyne, Wolfsburg to Man City was still in there. Paul Pogba, Man United, it was in there. And the point made is that there's a reason people don't spend loads of money on central midfielders. I don't know what it is, but there just is, because they don't, unless it's someone who's going to score 15 goals plus a season from midfield, or be an absolute genius level footballer who's going to, you know, like Bellingham's doing it for Real Madrid, and I would argue that Szoboszlai could actually do something similar for Liverpool. You're paying £100 million for defensive midfield, Arsenal just done it for Declan Rice. Where's your value? What do you get back for that? You spend £100 million on a centre forward because they're going to score goals that win games of football for you.
Or a goalkeeper or your
main leader centre half, because they'll shut things down and stop you from conceding goals. But the midfield stuff, there has to be a reason why this hasn't happened over all the years. And Enzo Fernandez, I mean, they're playing him in the 10.
I don't know.
Why is he not playing in the double pivot with Caicedo? Why are they again injuries? But yeah, mad.
The thing is, Enzo Fernandez is a good footballer. I agree with that. And he tore us apart on the opening day of the season. Since then, I've watched pretty much nearly every Chelsea game apart from this one, and I watched the highlights. And aside from him missing the target every time of being asked to, I've not actually seen anything special from him. And when you say £100 million, he should be levels above everyone else, especially when that team is so crap. You should be able to go, I feel sorry for Enzo, because he's on a different level to all of these people. And instead I'm watching him and I'm like, he's not £100 million player.
Is he already wondering, what am I doing here? Essentially, because you look at what they're up to and where they are in the league and the results they're getting. And I agree with your point, but he's better than most of them for me. He's already thinking, why am I playing footy here? He might be already looking at a way out, which is another problem Chelsea could face. Not with a lot of them, because a lot of them are crap. But the better ones, him, Levi Colwill, potentially further down the line, who knows, might start thinking, well, I want Champions League footy. But so they're going to face different problems down the line.
If they've spent £105 million on him, right, yeah, and he's their best player, and he wants to leave because everyone else around him is crap, Chelsea aren't going to sit there and let him go for a bargain. This is the problem that he's now got himself into.
He's a good footballer.
105 was outrageous to pay on him. He's not proved he's worth that. And now he's in a squad where he's the best midfielder. 100% agree with that. But if he wants to force his move, he's got a problem, because Chelsea are just going to sit there and go, you're my best midfielder, and who's going to spend that 100 and something
quid
on it?
And you're
on
an 8-year contract.
Exactly.
Chelsea currently sit 14th. I'll do this every week until we hit the 10-game point. I don't really care too much for the league table at this point, but in this instance, they've got 5 points from the first 6 games. Just Brighton are third on 15 points. Chelsea's ambition, they need their minimum expectation, it's because it's Chelsea, will be to get back into the Champions League.
It has to be.
Even if it's, you're talking Europa League, guaranteed Europa League place, which is fifth.
Sixth
as well.
You know,
what's the points difference there?
Villa are on 12 points and sixth. She's 7 points behind that already.
They're out of the title race and they're playing catch up.
Yeah.
6 games into the season.
Yeah.
There's international break coming up. And Chelsea of previous incarnations would have got rid of him in this international break coming up. Done.
Yep.
Get Frank Lampard back, see what he can do.
Thanks to Paul and the team for that one. Next up then, we've got Journo Insight. I spoke to Neil Jones, journalist extraordinaire, about Jurgen Klopp's future after the story emerged that he had turned down the chance to take over the German national side. So here's what Neil had to say about the gaffer.
I want to talk first. This happened last Friday and it was interesting, really. It was obviously, for those who don't know, Germany sacked Hansi Flick after, funny enough, Endo and his Japan team absolutely wiped the floor with them in a recent game. Paul Joyce reported again on Friday that Jurgen Klopp rejected the Germany job before they appointed Julian Nagelsmann on a short-term deal. Interesting because Germany hosts the Euros,
yeah.
And he could have been the manager of his home team in the Euros. A, fair enough that they've asked the question, but there's been a lot of talk recently about Jürgen's future. Obviously, he's under contract for another couple of years. It looks like he didn't even give this one a second thought, which is nice, because I know a lot of people would just presume he would just dismiss it, but I don't think it would be particularly easy for every single person in the world to go, you know what, here's my home country in the home Euros to come and manage them. But he has just knocked it on the head straight away.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I think with Jürgen, there's a few things. But one is obviously, I think he knows that when he wants that job, he can have it. You know, I don't think it's one of them where it's like, this is the only chance you get to be the Germany manager. You know, sometimes that is the case, isn't it, with clubs or with national teams. Yeah. You know, you say no now and you'll never get another one. Maybe it's like Graham Potter, for example, must have looked at Chelsea and thought, I think I'll ever get that opportunity. I think, obviously, you say, you know, yeah, what an honour, the home Euros, the, you know, the chance of glory. There's also the chance that you sort of look at Hansi Flick. Hansi Flick won everything at Bayern Munich. You know, was the real sort of hot property in football. It's not worked out for him, and all of a sudden his stock's plummeted. You know, if you do have a, imagine Germany went and had a sort of underwhelming or really poor Euros, and it's possible with the way that the team's been going. Yeah. You know, you've said goodbye to Liverpool to do that. You know, that would be in my mind. But also, I think just the way he's been speaking about this team just tells you that, you know, I don't think it's coincidental that he's been speaking this way, but that I think it's, I won't say re-energised them, but it's definitely energised them. Yeah. You know, it's given them this feeling of, oh, I'm really sort of, almost flashbacks, I think, you know, to sort of probably the start of his Dortmund journey and when he saw that team starting to emerge, probably the start of his Liverpool journey where he's seeing pieces falling into place. And, you know, I've heard him speak many, many times on camera and off camera, like watching training and sort of saying to, he like says to his coaches, you know, like well, look at this, you know, like this is unbelievable, you know, the standard of quality. So I think it was never likely to come there. I'm not surprised. Germany, obviously, listen, if you're the German FA, you're looking and saying, right, who's the man? I'm pretty sure, like those sort of police dramas when they have the suspects sort of lined up, I'm pretty sure the biggest picture on that board is Jürgen Klopp and he's the target number one. But yeah, I'm not surprised that he said no to it. I think there's an expectation that he will manage Germany one day, but I think it's still a fair way down. Like, he doesn't to me strike me as someone who's sort of easing into that approach of, I wouldn't mind a sort of more laid back management life. I think he wants the sort of day-to-day and he wants the ability to keep building something. And listen, if Liverpool carry on the way they're going, I think he is going to build something.
Absolutely. It was interesting, his comments, wasn't it? When he says, you know, this isn't year eight, this is year one. I think that was a great comment. Obviously, he's under contract till 2026. My hope is that that you talk about re-energising him, because he looked knackered when he's been speaking about it. I think he said last time when he signed the contract, I didn't want to leave Liverpool in this period of transition without me. Now they're going through that transition and it looks like, touch wood, he might have got it right again, which they've done on a couple of occasions now. It's just do I want to give this team to somebody else now? Because if it goes as well as his Dortmund build went and then as well as his Liverpool first build went, like, you know, go and reap the reward yourself. I wonder if I'm FSG now and he's in this greater mood, I'd be like that with a contract in front of his face. Can you do a little bit now?
I've heard people say that, and, you know, I know there was a little bit of sort of false hope put on Twitter yesterday, wasn't it? You guys tweeted something where it was, if you think I'm going to get excited about someone tweeting about a contract,
that sounds like something Dan would tweet.
Yeah, I mean, it was obviously a wind up thing, but you're right. I mean, I think as well, from his point of view, and listen, this is me speaking as the sort of devil's advocate a little bit. What has he not proven as a manager? What he hasn't proven is, can he do it again?
Yeah,
as in with the same club. So he got Dortmund to the top of the mountain, you know, nearly make Dortmund European champions, you know, having won back-to-back Bundesliga, unbelievable achievement. But it went away and it fell away, and he ended up still being successful, but not quite rekindling that glory. He got Liverpool to the top of the mountain, incredible, you know, 3-4 years of success, higher standards imaginable, but fell away. And now, you know, now he's rebuilding again. If you can do it again, and that was what, you know, that's what the great managers are sort of defined by, really, you know, the great managers I'm talking about. And I'm thinking of Ferguson as sort of probably the number one example, and maybe Wenger as the number one example, the opposite of, oh yeah, but Wenger had a golden period. Even Mourinho had a golden period, but it didn't last and it fell away. If Jürgen can get Liverpool back to, you know, even just winning the Europa League, winning, you know, competing for the title again, it just reaffirms this idea that, wow, like, what a manager. You know, it wasn't just how everything fell into place for him and he got the right people around him and Michael Edwards was doing all the good business and, you know, Man City had an off period or whatever. It just reaffirms this idea that, wow, this is some manager. And I do think that would, I'm not saying it would be top of his list. You know, he says often, doesn't he, oh, I don't read what people think or whatever. But I do think that idea of, you know, can we get that proper feel? And also, a little bit, can we get that feeling of those parades and that, you know, imagine winning the Premier League, even the Europa League, the Champions League, again, but with the supporters as well behind us. I think that would really, really sort of, it would be his utopia, really. And yeah, I think the only way he's going to be doing that is at Liverpool, isn't it? You're not going to get that feeling, you know, with the German national team or, you know, by going on a sabbatical for a year and waiting for another job to turn up. So I think he's still very much in that mix of proving himself again. Not that he needs to with Liverpool supporters, but maybe just, you know, as I say, cementing that legacy and idea that this is one of the great managers of the modern era, which, you know, for me he already is, but he's still, you know, you can still move further up that list.
We saw his reaction at full time. There's a clip on our YouTube show, if you haven't seen it, by the way, guys. And he was right banging. First of all, he seems to love the purple. Like he's yeah. rocking the. I mean, Liverpool are at home and he's still rocking the purple.
My girlfriend texts me 10 minutes into the game. I'll be WhatsApp up on my laptop and I just a Klopp's outfit and a heart eyes emoji. And I was like, yeah, and didn't care to me. I was looked at him and I was like, yeah, he's in purple, isn't he? So yeah. He just, did his luggage maybe get lost on the way back from Lask? But
he looked nice.
Yeah, no, but I think that's another one, isn't it? You know, like, you can tell with Jürgen, there are moments where he has his finger on the pulse of mood. And I remember it, the one I remember was when they beat Leeds 6-0 in that the quadruple season, where it was almost a little bit like Liverpool had they'd gone 10, 12 points behind City and they were starting to claw it back, but there was a lot of a mood where it was a bit like, it's not happening. And then he beat Leeds and it was almost like he went, right, press the button, and he give it, didn't he? You know, he give it beans, you know, in front of the cop, and it was like, right, we're in this, come on, let's have it. And I do think there is a little bit of a feeling of that now. It's like, you know, look, West Ham at home, it's not nothing new to beat West Ham at home. You know, they've not won many games at Anfield in the last 50 years. But there is that feeling of, that's another tough test passed. You know, that's 5 wins in a row. You know, look, we're in there now. Look, do you believe me now? You know, have you stopped worrying about the transfer window? Have you stopped worrying about having a number 6 or whatever? Come on, let's have it. And yeah, I do think he's sort of, he looks a little bit of a man reborn this season, doesn't he? And his team are following suit.
It looks like, I think, you know, sometimes as a fan or as a coach or whatever, anyone really, when you've got a good team, and you can tell sometimes, like, in boxing, I'm a big boxing fan, and you can tell when a boxer knows that, like, yeah, I'm probably going to beat this guy.
Yeah.
They carry themselves, they have an attitude. And Jürgen last year, he seemed a bit, again, I know he's had a couple of run-ins with people this year, but, like, he was very tetchy. He was always going, like, he's big, the smile's back. Like, I remember being on the cop and people were wanting to do the fist pumps and he was having none of it. I think we joined, and it was like, you could tell now he's got, I don't know if mojo's the right word, but, David said, didn't he, you know, this is a serious team. I think Jürgen thinks he's got a serious team now.
I think as well, I think you're right. I think it's a bit like, you know, a bit like mouthing off when you've got nothing to back it up. And no, that's a sort of very basic way of putting it. But there were a few moments last season where, and I said this to journalists at the time, and I think one of the questions was something I asked them. But there was a couple of times when journalists, and not to catch him out, not to be rude or anything, but asked him something where I thought, you know, if Liverpool were going for the title, he'd have bit and said, are you for real? Like, you know, are you really asking me that question? You know, but he actually would almost go, yeah, you're right. You know, like, we are, you know, slow starters at the moment, or we are sort of, yeah, we did look, you know, like we were lacking confidence, or yeah, we, whatever, you know, it was like he'd accepted that, you know, like, I can't defend that, or I can't sort of, you know, I can't fight for this team's honour at the moment, because that the evidence is there in front of you. I think he's very different now. Obviously, we've seen a few moments this season, of course, where he's, you know, he's not taken kindly to sort of the idea of criticism. But I think when you know you've got the artillery behind you, it's a lot easier to sort of be that kind of forceful, you know, defiant character. I think last season there was a few moments, I think, where he just looked a little bit browbeaten and a little bit sort of not out of ideas, but sort of sick. I think he actually said that at Wolves. I'm pretty sure he said, you know, I can only keep saying this for the same, you know, for a certain amount of time. We can't keep going back to playing 60 games last season. It's January, I think he said, or February. We've got to get over ourselves a little bit. And I think there was an element of that last season. It doesn't feel like that. I think one of the big things from this season feels like excuses are just being removed from the way, you know, transfer window doesn't matter. Early kickoff doesn't matter. You know, travel, Europa League doesn't matter. Oh, injury or suspension for Virgil van Dijk doesn't matter. It, you know, just we'll win. We'll get it out the way. And so far, so good. Listen, Saturday's huge. Huge, huge game. Because I think Tottenham are in a different way, but very similar. I actually covered their game at Burnley recently. They won 5-2, I think, up at Burnley. I definitely did cover it. but it reminded me a little bit, there was a little bit of Liverpool about it in the fans at the end, you know, in Turf Moor, where they were sort of worshipping Ange Postecoglou and sort of they were chanting, "We've got our Tottenham back," and this feeling of, ah, look, we're starting to love this team, and that makes them a dangerous proposition. You know, you saw them, I think they lose that game on Sunday against Arsenal 9 times out of 10 in recent years. They didn't, they fought back. So they're a serious proposition, and if Liverpool can go and get a good result there, I mean, that really is another huge hurdle passed on this sort of journey for, you know, re-establishing themselves as one of the top sides.
Absolutely. If Mike Gordon or FSG are watching, you can put the contract in front of him now. He's in a good mood. He'll go, yeah, you'll go and box that one off and we'll get another couple of years added on to the end of it.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.
A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number smart beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 50% on the Sleep Number limited edition smart bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at a Sleep Number store or sleepnumber.com.
Thanks very much, Fionnuala, for that one. Right then, let's move on. It's the final word show. Yes, Liverpool won 3-1 again. This time, of course, it was against Leicester City in the League Cup. And Dan Clubb hosted the final word show to bask in the glory of Liverpool advancing to the next round of the Carabao Cup. So yeah, check this one out as well.
Liverpool, like I say, gets back to 1-1, and we introduce, speaking about good subs, we introduce Darwin Nunez and a certain Dominic Szoboszlai. I don't know if you've heard of him, he's doing okay. Made me laugh, actually, because obviously I was there last night, and like 2 minutes, obviously did the Nunez chant go around and stuff like that. But like, I think like the first couple of minutes of Szoboszlai being on the pitch, he almost gets into a bit of space on the turn, and I think he essentially falls over the ball.
He does.
Gets it massively all wrong. Yeah. And everyone's like,
he is human.
Yeah. Okay, yeah. That wasn't what we expected. But anyway, not long after that, He similar to Darwin Nunez last week, he changes that around. I mean, Will, I'll come to you first on the goal, mate. Like, what are we witnessing here? Like, that is a violent, violent strike of a football, that. And what a goal, mate.
Mate, honestly, I can't even explain it. Because
you've got to have some guts, man, and some confidence in yourself to pull it off. And, you know, people keep comparing him to Gerrard. I'm like, yeah, cool, but just let him be him for now. Do you know what I mean? Let him run his course of who he is and become the player he wants to be. But his mate, he shot it, it went in, and he tried it again.
Yeah,
but, the shot itself, so the power, there was no chance at any... And the, where it went in the goal, it's like, no one could have got that. Like, for that speed as well.
Yeah, no, we could have had two keepers, mate. Not a chance in hell. Not a single chance. Like I say, I mean, we spoke briefly about it upstairs, Mick. I mean, talk about the goal itself. But in terms of strikes, from a Liverpool perspective here, where does that rank in the ones you've seen? Because you've had John Arteta, you've had Gerrard himself down the years, pull off some absolute thunderbolts. But that's right up there, isn't it?
It's the power he gets, and it just he just strokes his foot, and it's just like, it's not even like he's trying, and the way he hits it, obviously he hits it so cleanly, the keeper doesn't even move when it's in the back of the net, basically, isn't it? Like, it looks like the keeper dives late, but it's just the speed of the ball. Yeah, I was trying to think of, like, obviously Gerrard's the easy comparison to make. You've got Risa, I guess. Ox is against City where he wellies it, but that one, I don't know why, but that one just seemed like it was extra powerful. I don't know what it was. I don't know if it was going to be a 1-1 and it was a bit
powerful.
The game was a bit needly because it was Leicester, and he just thought, you know, oh, fuck this, I'm just going to hit this as hard as I can. And
it was even more confirmation, wasn't it, for us? It was even more like, we've been bigging him up for the last like 3-4 weeks, and you always still have that tiny bit of doubt maybe, and then things like that just confirm, we're not just getting, because we as Liverpool fans, we get overexcited sometimes, right? But that just confirms, okay, yeah, cool. He is who we think he is. Like, just, yeah, brilliant.
No, 100%, mate. I absolutely agree with you. And it's funny, and forgive me, people watching or listening, because I said this pretty much last week, but we spoke a lot when we signed him, and all the sort of the feedback was, he's great quality, great technician, strikes a footy really well, he'll have magic moments. And we again spoke upstairs, and the highlight reels were all these absolute worldies. He was scoring the free kick, and you think, God, we're going to have fun with this lad. But for weeks, it's been like his hard work, it's been his pressing, his endeavour, his defensive duties getting back, and we've all been waxing lyrical about that. And then all of a sudden, he scores the goal against Bournemouth a couple of weeks ago, and you think, okay. And then he does that last night, and you think, okay, so he's got everything then. This guy's got absolutely everything.
It's so strange how it can go from when I was watching the transfer, your transfer podcast, well, watching it and listening, and some like guessing how to say his name. Guessing how to say his name, and now everybody knows his name. It's just like,
well, I think everyone's got their own interpretation. I don't think anyone's got it nailed on. To be honest, I know I haven't, but I remember sitting literally in this chair on one of the news shows when David Ornstein tweeted Liverpool were interested in him, and I was doing a news show probably about Romeo Lavia. Forgive me, it might not have been. almost certainly was. Somebody in our chat said, "Oh, Liverpool about to trigger the release clause for Dominic Szoboszlai," and at the time I could not say his name. I honestly thought someone was taking the piss just to try and get me to say that surname, because you've made an absolute hash of it. It was a nightmare. It is a nightmare.
I think even just like typing it on Twitter, my phone got used to it, so I was like, thank fuck my phone tells me now. So I just type in Zob and it pops up for me. Is it an S, is it a Z, is it what? But now it's like, it's in there.
He's become a household name in Liverpool, especially already. Like, he's not been here that long, so.
You know what, it's funny you should say that, because I was driving home the other night, and a kid, Liverpool kit, on his bike, cycling along, he had Szoboszlai 8 on the back of his shirt.
Banging.
And it's that, obviously, that's happening across Liverpool, of course, but the first time, obviously you go to game, you'll see it all the time, but just passing the street, and I seen it, and I thought, okay, yeah, we're onto something here with this lad. I mean, what a strike. Quad bod, Romeo Lavia, who's that? Yeah, never heard of him. Dom Szoboszlai is how Disney would make a footballer. I like that. I want to touch on a moment, Mick, before the goal. And the goal's so good, people have probably forgotten about it, and rightfully so. But Endo actually provides the assist for this goal.
Yeah.
I don't know. Oh, you knew that. Okay, it's good. People are forgetting about that. And the pass is actually really good. Like, it's threaded between, like, there's three Leicester players half in front of him, half trying to stop the pass happening, and Endo finds it really well. And to speak about the assist and the fact he plays that pass, but Endo generally, I thought last night, grew into the game, and I think he got better and better as it went on.
Yeah, I think in the it was the last game, weren't it, where he looked... He just looked like he was a couple of seconds behind, like people would be flying into him, and he just looked like he went at the races. So obviously online with people were like, oh, is this the right fella? Who's this and whatever? What's he going to provide? It's like, it doesn't matter how he's experienced as he is. He still needs time to come into a new country.
It's not sharp yet.
Different speed of footy as well, isn't it? And I think especially like the last half an hour, last night, I thought he really grew into it. He was making fouls, he was getting stuck in, he was all blood and thunder. It's what you want him to be. Mm. I think it's, again, he's another player that's not going to start for us in the current strongest 11, but what an option to come off the bench if you need someone to go in there and get stuck in and just make fouls, just get stuck in and just be busy. It's hard. I mean, we're making comparisons to Szoboszlai and Gerrard, but I think like if you can be like a small version of Mascherano in some way, then we've got an absolute player. Because I think even in that last half hour, I mean, making Mascherano comparisons is probably a bit mad at this stage, like, but I think if he can just be some form of that and just do the dog work and the dirty work, then it's going to be perfect for us, what we want to try to achieve.
I think he'll be really good at, you know, once he's found his sort of form, about slowing games down, you know, coming on and, like you said, just doing the hard work and making the little fouls and just slowing the games down if we need them to. But yeah, similar to what you're saying, I think he started slow. Like, it did look like he was in slow motion at times. But like you say, the speed of the game is so much quicker, and they are an ex-Prem team. It's not like we're facing an actual championship team. We're facing Leicester, who were decent.
And the top of the championship, flying high. I mean,
they've kept
confidence.
Most of the players on as well. So.
Decent side, absolutely. Yeah. Wilfred, indeed, he came off the bench, and he at one time was touted as being better than Leicester, essentially, when he was in the Premier League.
Jeremy Hall, no, last got against us last year.
Yeah, exactly, mate. Yeah, look, I think as made up friend, though, I think he probably needed that, because some of the words coming from Klopp were not worrying. And Endo himself, but saying, like, almost like reiterating the fact that we need him and we wanted him. And when that starts happening, so really into career, you start thinking, aye, why is Klopp feeling the need to go into bat for him?
Justifying, yeah.
But yeah, exactly, yeah. But like I said, I think he needed that performance last night, and I was made up for him, I think, first 20 minutes, because I was almost sticking up for him last week on one of the, I think it's the IMR show, and I was saying, let's just reserve judgment on him a little bit, because you're right, people on social media and some people in here were kind of saying, I'm not sure what he is. And for the 20 minutes last night, I was watching him thinking, God, I might be the wrong here. Like, he might not be it. But like I say, I think he come round last night. I think he had a good end to the game.
I think, sorry, Dan. I think Klopp said something, didn't he? Like, about he's been too nice or something.
Yeah.
I think that's something that, like, he's probably coming in and he's like, well, there's all these good players here. I'm probably not going to start and whatever else. So it's having confidence in his own ability as well. I think we've got a lot of players that need to have a bit more confidence in themselves. I think Darwin Nunes has now started to show that. But I think if Endo can do that as well, then he is pushing to start in games.
Well, when there's competition for places, you need lads to be willing to fight for the place. Because otherwise, you're not going to lose, aren't you? You know what I mean?
And let's look at the team that we've got at the moment, the whole squad. There's no way anybody just walks into a team anymore, apart from like Trent and Virgil. But that, like, in terms of the attacking midfield, it's a battle to get onto them. And I feel like you're talking about confidence. And I remember, you know, when we had... Like when we were in the Prem in the Champions League, it was like there was no doubt at all, ever. Like, you could see it in the players. They'd go on and be like, yeah, we're just going to go out there and do our thing.
Yeah.
And that's slowly coming back to certain players. You can see it in their body language. When they get on the pitch, they've just got a bit of swagger about them. But yeah.
No, it's good signs. Sorry, quite a bad returns in our discourse. Endo was 5'8" at kickoff and 6'2" by the final. I like that. I like that a lot. He's a silky DM and doesn't get noticed so much. Yeah, do you know what? That's an interesting point, actually, because I thought last night, although he did all the DM stuff really well and he was harassing players and he was busy and his position was really good. Like, when Leicester were clearing, he was more often than not the first one, sort of recycling and getting us back on the front foot, which is massive for that role. But his progressive passing and his use of the ball was actually really intelligent last night, I thought, as well. So, yeah. Nice performance, happy for the lad. Glad we could give him his flowers as well.
Cheers to Dan, Will and the team for that one. Hope you guys enjoy the final. Then let's crack on with Expert Insight. Of course, it was announced earlier in the week that FSG had sold a minority stake in Liverpool Football Club. And yeah, who else to speak to for Dan Club on Expert Insight than the Echo's financial expert, Dave Powell. A really good conversation with Dan and Dave. Check out what they had to say.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to the Redmen TV and your latest edition of Expert Insight. I'm delighted to say I'm joined at relatively short notice by Liverpool Echo business and football writer Dave Powell. How are you doing, mate? You okay?
Really good, Dan. Thank you, mate. How are you?
Yeah, mate, I'm all good. Yeah, nice one for joining me. Like I say, it kind of got sprung upon us a little bit this afternoon, this, and normally these things are quite pre-planned and we know what we're going to talk about and it's all in line. But yeah, the relative shock announcement this afternoon, I think it's fair to say, of FSG Liverpool confirming they have agreed minority investment from Dynasty Equity over in America, obviously New York-based firm. I suppose to start with, for people who haven't seen it or anyone sort of a broad overview of what exactly has happened, if you could give us that.
Yes, I mean, this investment search has been going on for a while now. It's kind of the door was kicked open last November, wasn't it, to a when a sales deck was presented and Mike Gordon moved across to seconded to kind of take care of the investment search. A lot of names were kicked about, many erroneously, so the likes of the QIA, etc. That was never on the table. But they finally found a minority partner, and it's Dynasty Equity. I believe it's low single digit percentage they've acquired, but it'll be for a sum between $100-$200 million. But what it will do is it's not for transfers, which will be to the ire of some Reds fans, I imagine. But what it does do is pay off down the bank debt that was accrued from the construction of, you know, the Anfield Road construction, the training ground at Kirkby, repurchasing Melwood, all those type of things coming out of the pandemic. So FSG don't like having that kind of debt sitting on their balance sheet. So effectively it clears that. I believe the money's already come in and already gone out. So it kind of, it's an open and closed book really. But it brings... at least allows us to draw a line under this long search. And I think most telling thing about it all was it's the reaffirmation, I suppose, of FSG's longer term commitment to the football club, and quite explicit in the fact that the football club isn't for sale and they're not seeking another minority partner. Chance that this particular deal could evolve into something more further on down the line, but for the time being this is what they were searching for. Caught me by surprise a bit. Didn't believe it was this investment deal was close. Nor did Dynasty Equity really register in terms of what they might do. They're only a new firm. 2022, they were founded by real industry veterans in the US, Don Cornwell, Jonathan Nelson, and both of them who have extensive experience in terms of sporting acquisitions. So Nelson played a key role in the Yes Network, getting that up and running a few years back. Don Cornwell, again, he's got headed up the sports department at Morgan Stanley for years before he moved into private equity, running his own firm. So they've got a wealth of experience, and also a senior advisor to the company is David Ginsburg, who's one of the FA partners, former director of Liverpool, and sat on the board. So there's a lot of this kind of a simpatico relationship which exists throughout this whole thing. So it does make sense on the face of it. I was expecting, if I'm honest, more of a potentially a business which may arrive, not being specific about Liberty Media, but a company like that whereby they might offer something else in terms as well as capital. But Dynasty may offer that further on down the line, but for the time being, it's all what this is, business transaction.
Yeah, I was going to ask you about that actually, and we'll touch upon it now, given that you mentioned it. Like, we spoke recently about Liberty Media, and the fact that did make a lot of sense in terms of the expertise and what they'd bring to the table, and how they'd look to advance Liverpool Football Club as a business, as a product, as an entity in many ways. And it's interesting that we clearly haven't gone down that route, because as you've kind of alluded to there, this Dynasty Equity, they bring finance, they bring money, but they don't necessarily bring that similar level of expertise, I think I'm right in saying.
They do it from an individual point of view, not so much from the assets that they already invest in that might be able to be plugged into Liverpool in kind of a vertical way, I suppose, because it's a company which is still pretty much in its infancy. Liberty Media obviously have a lot of things on their plate. The F1, the great success with Drive to Survive, a big content play. They own Sirius XM, all those type of things. So they know the media, but so do the individuals in Dynasty, if I'm honest. So Don Cornwell, Jonathan Nelson, they both, both worked on expanding media deals, one of them with the MLS, the other one with the MLB and the NBA. I mean, Don Cornwell served as an advisor to both the NFL and the NBA. So the people that know what they're talking about. So it won't just be a case of this is just anyone who can provide cash. I mean, they could have gone down that route. This is people they know, people they can probably tap into. But for now, what it does really is just solve the issue they wanted solving, but potentially gives them something to open up in the future. Although my feeling, initially when we were talking about Liberty Media, et cetera, was that it would provide them with a very clear out, a business so big that they could accrete their investment and then take over FSG stakeholding over time. But This kind of is very much, a, like I mentioned before, really a reaffirmation of their position that they are at Liverpool for the long term, I think. I think it draws a very thick line underneath what's been, obviously, Twitter and or X, or whatever it is now, has been rife with rumour of this, that and the other for months. And that's what happens. And I knew as soon as the transfer window closed, we'd get rumours around the QIA and Saudi Arabia and Singapore investment funds, etc. None of those transpired because no talks from people I know who were close to it and never transpired with those organisations. But also, it was never mentioned to me about Dynasty Equity, so I can't claim to lay claim to have prior knowledge about that. But usually that's because... I think it goes to show how in-house and how close to their chest FSG keep these things. It's kind of, you know, they it's something which has been a hallmark of it, really, a lot of these things. I mean, these are deals done with a close circle of people, people they trust, so there's no leaks anywhere. And it's kind of been done quite swiftly. And I don't know whether it will show in terms of the debt being paid down in the forthcoming financial results. It might be the following year, but I believe the money's come in, gone out. So, but yeah, I think it, what it does is just really hammer home the fact that this is FSG see the continued rise in valuation of Liverpool Football Club. And what they have to do as part of that is to invest into what happens on the pitch, obviously. But Dynasty Equity, the reason they're investing is for the value of the football club when they exit, and private equity usually exits in 3 to 5 years, give or take. So, but it could be longer. They could stay in for 10 years, 15 years, but it'd be for as long as the valuation keeps on rising. I anticipate Liverpool's will probably grow a couple of billion before this plays out in the next few years.
Yeah, you would imagine so. It's interesting you mention sort of the time frame there. I spoke to a reporter from Private Equity News, must be 8 or 9 months ago now, and he said a very similar thing to me, because this is what they do. This is their modus operandi. They come in, they stick around for a couple of years, they sort of get back what they put in, and some, and then away they go onto the next one, essentially. So it'd be interesting to see how that plays out. And you're right, obviously, there's a clear link there with David Ginsberg, like you're saying. This, it shouldn't be a huge surprise that this has happened. Once you dig a little bit deeper, it kind of makes a lot of sense. And obviously, as you say, it's happened kind of behind the scenes and just kind of been sprung upon us a little bit. You touched on it there, but I wanted to ask you sort of in a plainer sense, and I think you've already addressed it on social media, so forgive me, but the key question, essentially, out of all this is, what do Dynasty Equity get? And is it as simple as a longer-term profit? Will they be looking to make money from this in a couple of years' time, like you say?
I mean, every investor wants to make money. There's a longer plan for a lot of private equity in sport now. There is a view that these valuations, while they won't go up forever, because that's, you know, nothing goes up forever. What goes up must come down eventually, but there is still a long way to go with that. And the reason I say that is because in the US, in North American sports, there is valuations, multiple of revenue of 11, 12, 13 in some cases. Valuations of 7, 8, 9 billion for some of the NFL teams, you know, the Dallas Cowboys or the New York Yankees in the MLB, Golden State Warriors in the NBA. A lot of that's because these deals, I mean, these leagues are protected. They're closed leagues. There's no relegation promotion, but in reality, there's no relegation or promotion. There's no relegation for Liverpool. You can miss out on the Champions League, but there's no relegation, really, if we're being honest. But what there is less security around media rights deals. So 3 years, there's for a long period, there's been a cap on how long the cycle that the Premier League can engage with broadcasters. So it's been 3 years. Problem is for broadcasters, it costs a lot of money to get into that space and become a media partner. You have to, the setup costs are enormous, which is why Sky dominate. They've already swallowed those costs. And then, you know, but for any new players coming into the market, the setup costs are absolutely astronomical. So to get involved in that is hugely expensive. And to be limited at 3 years is a real hindrance. I believe they're going to extend it to 4 years for the next cycle, which will mean that valuations will go up because the media rights deals will be stronger. Until such time that it kind of aligns with it, because the NFL signed a 10-year, 100 billion, deal with the broadcaster for the broadcast rights there. you know, that's absolutely astronomical. But that's for investors, that's security over a long period of time, and that's what they want. So media rights is core to it all. Media rights are going to continue to go up, certainly for the next cycle, because when BT and Amazon and Sky renegotiated last time, it was just coming out of COVID. They retained the status quo. People were unsure. But even then, in 2021, they negotiated a deal for their international rights, which were hugely expensive. I know this is a really long-winded way to kind of explain the point, but media rights are hugely important to all of this. They will continue to rise, and team valuations will continue to rise. So this, call it $150 million investment. I'm saying that just probably because it's the point between 100 and 200 million. I don't know the exact figure. Depending on the stake they have in Liverpool over time, they could exit their position in Liverpool without FSG having to sell. They could exit their position in Liverpool for a far greater price in 3-5 years. And that's the investors who invest with them, that's what they want. They want the return eventually. They don't, you know, football isn't really a cash business. It's an equity business, and it's done on that basis, really. I mean, if you're looking at in terms of taking profit from a profitable business, I mean, Liverpool made a profit of after tax of what, 4.5 million, something like that last year. And that's not going to, you know, that's not really enough to keep any investor engaged. The value lies in the value proposition and the potential for it to rise further in the future. And I think that's what you get with Liverpool. Mm. Dynasty will know that the valuation is almost certainly going to rise, likely, almost certainly beyond another billion in the next three years, purely because of the value of the media rights, which will increase. And it's a win-win for them. It solves FSG's problem. And by the, you know, they could exit their minority position in 3 years, 5 years, or they could ride it out with FSG and increase their position over time. But yeah, they're playing the long game here. There's no short-term wins for them here. When the price is right, like FSG, I mean, the FSG are in the business of value creation as opposed to seeking profit from their businesses. So that's where it'll come into. So, I think this is a game that they'll play for at least 5 years, probably, maybe longer. It could be the start of a long-term relationship that turns into something else. But for now, the value is very clear for Dynasty.
And finally, let's have a little go into the deep dive archives, shall we? Yes, indeed. I, this time, was joined by Josh Williams, filling in for the poorly Chris Pajak. Hopefully, Chris is feeling a bit better now. In fact, I know he is, because I've literally been speaking to him. But yeah, at time recording, Chris was feeling a little bit unwell. So I spoke to Josh Williams at This Thing's Covered, all about Curtis Jones and his development in this Liverpool side. Check it out. Genie Wijnaldum was labelled with this all the time. It's like, what does he do? He doesn't score much, which was fair. He didn't score too many. When he did, they were often big goals. Does he create anything? No, not really. He's not like the most creative player. All the creativity was coming from Trent, maybe from Andy Robertson at that time. Are we at a point where, like, is it the role? Is Curtis doing the Genie Wijnaldum? Is he getting Klopp's like Liverpool 2.0 version of Genie? Someone who is comfortable getting the ball. We've seen on the he receives the ball well, as the stats show there. Mm. He plays progressive passes. Yeah, he does that as well. But you're not getting that end product. That kind of does describe a bit of Genie Wijnaldum.
Yeah, he is very similar to Genie, I think, in terms of his profile and that and what he offers and stuff. But then I don't think it's the same role. I think obviously the system's changed. We've now got a midfield box at times because Trent is inverting. Jones is now playing much higher up, whereas Wijnaldum was a lot more responsible for covering as fullback. You know, Robertson was advancing, wasn't he?
Yeah.
So I think the difference in that sense, but in terms of, I suppose, if you imagine like Liverpool as a recipe, if you think of that, like Jones, I think, is offering similar ingredients, if you like, to what Wijnaldum was offering, in the sense that he never loses the ball, which we will touch on. Very press resistant, can get out of pressure and stuff. Isn't particularly creative, as we've just touched on. Wijnaldum just never created chances. He did arrive late in the box at times and score massive goals for Liverpool, but he was never really much of a creative spark who, I'll put it this way, I think if you had Wijnaldum on the ball in the centre circle as an opponent, you wouldn't really be particularly worried, would you? I think that's one of the reasons maybe why we upgraded and looked towards Thiago, who was similar in the sense of keeping the ball, but was just a lot more penetrative with his passing.
Do you think as well, going back to that, obviously the creative sparks of his here, there's only so many chances you can make, a team can make. Yeah. And if Mo Salah's making like 15 of them, and Szoboszlai and Roberts are making 10, each, you know, like someone's got. Is it just a case of that the attackers are going different way? Because I was thinking, rather than playing the final pass, is Curtis playing the pass to the pass? You know, because what I've noticed is, like, Salah's making a lot of chances for players. It used to be Salah might have been the man getting on the end of chances.
Yeah.
You know, does this new system facilitate this point where, rather than being the man to feed a Nunes or feed a Salah or feed a Diaz, actually you're the man feeding them to feed somebody else? You get what I'm saying?
Yeah, well, this is one of the reasons why he is so important for me, because I think earlier in the season, if you think of Chelsea in particular, I think that was a good example of that game. Liverpool played with like an entire team of forwards. I think off the top of my head, I might be wrong in saying this, to be honest. Did Jones play that game?
No, he didn't.
He was injured, wasn't he? Yeah, so I think Klopp played Gakpo in Jones's role, didn't he? Yeah. Forwards everywhere and that. And I think we posted something like 35% possession. Yeah. And Klopp in his next presser said it was an absolute joke.
Yeah, assuming.
Yeah, he said it was not the intent. You know, it just kind of happened. And I think a lot of that stemmed from just so many attacking players on the pitch. If everyone is trying to create chances, mate, that's what happens. And it turns into basketball, you're losing the ball all the time, lots of turnovers, chaos. And when it's like that, for example, you can't really accommodate a Nunes, because Nunes is going to make the game even more chaotic, and you end up just, it's just like a war. It's like a war zone, mate, on the pitch.
I suppose, like I say, going back to the Wijnaldum comparison, that was kind of one of the things we always said about Wijnaldum, and it was always like, he's always getting picked for the stars, so he must be doing something right, but he does. Yeah. He offers you that control, the press resistance, actually good at the press as well, something that Curtis did. And obviously, there's another viz here. Obviously, it's comparing, it's last year, but it's players who retain possession in the Premier League. It's comparing basically everyone from last season. And Curtis, again, he features highly on this. That was something that I always felt with Wijnaldum. It was that you could give him the ball in any situation, and he'd do it in a different way than Curtis. Wijnaldum might have been a bit more physical about it. Curtis, you mentioned before, mate, is he too slow on the ball? Perhaps that's what this is coming back to, is that he never gives it away.
Yeah.
Like, he's all, you know, look at his passing accuracy. It's third on that list of midfielders last year, if you want to talk through that. But
yeah,
that's obviously what Jürgen wants in this player. There's got to be someone who is offering you that bit of control and that bit of calm.
Yeah,
you can't play a footy game at 90 miles an hour for 90 minutes. It's just going to be chaos. And you saw that Chelsea game was a little bit like this. Liverpool were hanging on. In that game, they were crying out for someone to just keep the ball, get your foot on the ball, give your defenders a break. And it looks like the Statue Curtis is the man if for that job, which Wijnaldum often was as well.
Yeah, well, if you think of like Firmino, for example, Firmino's left the club. And I think elements of Firmino offered in the final third, he wasn't much of an output merchant really, but he offered kind of like almost like a glue in the most pressurised area of the pitch. Yeah. He made the ball stick, allowed Liverpool to kind of build these attacks and sustain attacks crucially and probe kind of thing. And that's what Jones is offering now, I think. And again, going back to that viz that you've just mentioned there, this is midfielders only, Premier League last season, and every player there attempted a minimum of 650 passes in the Premier League. So Jones, as you can see,
you're happy with those sample size numbers you went to, please. You're good with them ones?
No, this is much better, yeah. I should have just used this business for a long, to be honest. But I think one of the interesting things about this is if you look at the names around Jones, there's a familiar theme there in that all of those players are deep lying players, basically.
Rodri's top, Basuma's second, Jones is third, then you've got Casado and Fabinho and Højbjerg and Endo Fernandez and Thomas Partey.
Yeah, yeah. See what I mean?
They're DMs. They're lads who are playing at the base of a midfield, yeah.
Yeah, they're all the lads who are focusing on being a six, being a whole midfield player, and they're basically just playing 5-yard passes to the most creative lad on the pitch.
That's very interesting, because looking down, Lamina, yeah, Declan Rice, yeah, Lavia, we know about him, Samari, yeah, Kovacic, Skip. I mean, there's a few others outlined, Ndidi, Idrissa Gueye, they are, it's a lot of DMs.
Yeah,
it feels like for an attacking player to be so high on that list, where Curtis is, is that hugely impressive? Am I wrong to say that? Because it does stand out, doesn't it?
Yeah, it is really unique. It if you look at his data, look at his numbers and that, it's an area that really stands out in comparison to the typical player who will play that high up the pitch. Like, if you think of them off the top of your head, you think of like De Bruyne, Bruno, James Maddison, you know, all them players, and they create so much, but as a result of creating so much, they lose the ball all the time. And if you think of Liverpool, Trent creates an absolute ton. Salah, Nunes, Diaz, Gakpo, you know, Szoboszlai, you've got loads and loads and loads of them. Jones really doesn't have to do it, mate. In the confines of this team, if he can be kind of this, almost like a balancer, like a counterweight to the team, he can offer so much value doing that and that alone.
That is Wijnaldum. You've just described Wijnaldum. Yeah. It's a different setup. But that was Genie's job. Yeah. Genie's job was to win the ball, keep the ball, pass it to the good lads and let them sort the good stuff out. He probably had a bit more defensive responsibility than Jones perhaps has in this, but you can see why people are, you know, when you mentioned like the Wijnaldum comparison, like you say, it's a different system, but his job within the team feels like very, very, very similar. Like, and and maybe that is the criticism. Genie got loads of it, and then all of a sudden he wasn't playing once, and you'd be like, oh my God, we really miss Genie Wijnaldum.
Yeah.
We've Curtis had a couple of injuries at the start of the season, and then I remember he was fit for Villa. He was just straight back in the team. It does feel like...
That Villa game, by the way, was our best of the
best team. Game, yeah, and it does feel like Jürgen's gone, no, we need that. We've got all this creativity, we've got all these lads, like you say, trying things. Bear in mind, we haven't actually got a proper number six. So if you keep giving the ball away all the time,
exactly,
this poor lad behind is going to be in trouble. It's a no-brainer. He's doing what he's meant to do.
Yeah,
this is the Genie Wijnaldum conversation that we had 5 years ago.
Definitely. If you put Bruno Fernandes there, he would probably create a lot more. He'd lose the ball a lot more, and it'd have a massive impact on the system. I don't think it'd be a positive impact. I think it'd be a negative one. I think it'd result in Liverpool losing a bit of control.
Yeah.
And if you think of the nature of this system, and it's the kind of system that. We only form this shape when we've got possession secured. We still defend with 4-3-3. So if you're forming a new shape when you've got possession, you need to hold possession first to form that shape so that Trent can come inside and all that. And then if you can get the ball in the final third and things and everyone pushes up a little bit, Robertson's down here a little bit and things like that, that's then when you start probing because you've got the box in shape and things. And if you lose the ball now, then you've got this kind of central box to go and immediately press. Curtis Jones has been brilliant at that, by the way. His pressing's been off the scale.
Yeah.
And you regain the ball and you restart in the same shape, and you don't really get beaten very often on a transition, conceding counter-attacks all the time, because you've got such a structure to go and immediately regain the ball if you lose it. So he's perfect for it. It's similar to Wijnaldum in the sense of the dynamic that he's offering on the pitch, the elements that he's adding to the team. But again, going back to the system, positionally and stuff like that, it's slightly different. So you could argue maybe it's an evolution.
Yeah, no, absolutely, and that makes sense.
Right then, thanks very much for Josh for coming in. Thanks for you guys for listening to the latest episode of the Red Men Weekly Podcast. Hope you've enjoyed it. Like I said before, if you do want to check out those shows in their entirety, and of course, they're out every single week. We always have final words after every game. We have journal insights every week, expert insights every week, the deep dive every week. There is so much content to keep you entertained, whether it's on your commute, at home, wherever you are in the world, you can get involved over on redmenplus.com. So yeah, you go and check those out. And we'll be back next week with another episode of the Red Men Weekly Podcast. I'll see you all then. Take care.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.